Can you believe the spring holy days are over already? It seems like they went really fast this year. In fact, when we were going out to eat last night, we were preparing the kids as we're going, you know, they're going to be bringing bread to the table. You can't eat that. And no, you can't have a cheeseburger. And make sure you don't get croutons on your salad. And we ended up waiting so long, the time we got in the restaurant, it's like, you can have a cheeseburger. You can eat the bread. But the days did seem to go by really fast. And now it's time for us to move on. We look forward to the next holy day. But I want to look at something for a minute that as we move on, that we be sure to take with us from the spring holy days. On Passover night, I asked Mr. Wayne Brewer, I said, what would you be doing if you knew in a couple of hours you were going to be arrested, tortured, beaten, and the next day put to death? Mr. Brewer said, I believe I'd run. And I thought about his response, and I thought, I believe I would too. I want to look at the foot-washing attitude, because I think that is something that we need to take with us. It's something that we need to have as we're going into the Passover, but it's something that we need to make a part of our lives and take with us from now on. Now, I would like to read, starting in Mark chapter 13. Nope, John. John chapter 13. Verses 1 to 5. This is the account of Christ washing the disciples' feet. John chapter 13, verses 1 through 5. And I want to read through these five verses and take out some points here that we can all put to use in our lives in developing and maintaining a foot-washing attitude. John 13. Now before the feast of Passover, when Jesus knew that his hour had come, that he would depart from the world to the Father, having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. And supper being ended, the devil having already put it into the heart of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, to betray him, Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands, and that he had come from God, and that he was going to God, rose from supper, laid aside his garments, took a towel, and girded himself. After that, he poured water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel with which he was girded. Again, I ask you, what would be on your mind at this time if you were Christ? Well, running was not on his mind. I want to look at three aspects of the foot-washing attitude. There's many more, but I'm going to pick just three out of these five verses to look at this afternoon. And the first one is love. Jesus Christ had love, not just for his disciples, but for those who were getting ready to punish him and put him to this horrible scourging and ultimately put him to death, and also for all of us here today. Jesus Christ's focus and thoughts were on us. Let's look back again at John 13, verse 1. He knew that his hour had come. He knew what was about to happen. Christ's mind, though, was on his disciples. He knew that his hour had come, that he should depart from this world to the Father. Having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. Christ's focus was on his disciples and his love for them. And they were about to find out just how much love Christ actually had for them. I don't think at this point they fully understood it. Let's turn back to John 3 and verse 16. Christ had mentioned many times to his disciples what was going to happen. And again, I don't know that the whole gravity of the situation was taken in by the disciples. But John 3:16, we're told, God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever believes in him should not perish but have everlasting life. That was the level of love that Christ had for his disciples and for all of us. And in Romans 5 and verse 8, I'm going to start in verse 6, Romans 5, verse 6. For when we were still without strength in due time, Christ died for the ungodly. For scarcely for a righteous man will one die, yet perhaps for a good man someone would even dare to die. But God demonstrates his own love towards us, though while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. Christ died for us when man was at enmity with God. Yet he was willing to lay down his life for us. He had an incredible amount of love that was one of his main focuses during this foot washing ceremony. Another thing that is a trait of the foot washing attitude is humility. Christ had an incredible amount of humility. Again, John 13, verses 3 to 4. Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands, and that he had come from God, and that he was going to God, rose from supper, laid aside his garments, took a towel, and girded himself. This statement in verse 4 says an awful lot about Christ and the sacrifice he made for us. Laid aside his garments, and took the towel, girded himself up as a servant. He emptied himself of his deity. He laid aside his garments. He became as his creation. He put off being a spirit being to live among men. Not just to live among men to teach, but to live among men to serve. And we're told to let this mind also be in us, which was in Christ Jesus. Christ lived a very humble life from the very beginning. Let's turn back to Luke chapter 2. Think about how you would expect for a king, a future king, to be treated when he is born. It's not the birth that Christ experienced. Christ wasn't even born in his family's own house. We'll start reading here in Luke 2, verses 6 to 7. So it was that while they were there, the days were completed for her to be delivered. And she brought forth her firstborn son and wrapped him in swaddling cloths and laid him in a manger because there was no room for them in the inn. We've all heard this story, and sometimes we don't really think too much about it. We know why they were there. There was a census going on, and they had to travel back to be in part of their family's homeland to be counted. But think about where Christ was born. Now, there's a lot of different thoughts as to where, what type of a room he was in. Some say it was a stable, some say it was a cave or a barn. It's possible it was a room on a house where animals were brought in at night, maybe even where the Passover lamb would come and stay before the Passover. Certainly wasn't a guest room. It's not something that was made for someone to live in, someone who's coming to visit to stay in. And yet this is the room where Christ was born. And once he was born, there wasn't even like a crib or anything there for him. He was put in an animal's feeding trough. Very humble beginnings for Christ's life. There's, in John 8, verse 41, you don't have to turn there, I'll read this to you, but there's hint made that maybe Christ was accused throughout his life of being illegitimate. Again, not a lifestyle you would expect from a king. He said to the people, "You do the deeds of your father." And they came back, "We are not born of fornication. We have one Father, and that's God." So maybe these accusations and rumors followed Christ throughout his life that he was an illegitimate son. And also Christ's death. Again, very humiliating way to die. The crucifixion was considered the most painful and degrading form of capital punishment in the Roman Empire. It was used not only to be painful, but the whole experience was meant to be humiliating. Think about it. After Christ was beaten and scourged, he had to walk through town to where they were going to crucify him, in front of all the people, and then the crucifixion was a public display. It was meant to be humiliating. It was used by the Romans on slaves and the lowest types of criminals. It was so horrible that it was not even to be used on a Roman citizen. They could not even do this to a Roman citizen because it was considered so beneath a Roman citizen even. Well, there's one thing that was always under attack, it seems like, during Christ's life, and that was his humility. Turn with me, if you will, to Matthew 4, and we're going to read verses 1 through 10. Here we see Satan coming to tempt Christ. And he begins to attack his humility. He wants to see if he can break him somehow. And for some reason, Satan seems to think this would be a good route to go after. Matthew 4. Then Jesus was led up by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. And when he had fasted 40 days and 40 nights, afterward he was hungry. Now when the tempter came to him, he said, "If you are the Son of God, command that these stones become bread." Again, Satan brings up this conditional word. If you're the Son of God, do this. Satan knew he was the Son of God. He was part of his creation. But Satan says, "If you're the Son of God, command that these stones become bread." Knowing that Christ was uncomfortable during this fast, tempting him with food. But he answered and said, "It's written, man shall not live by bread alone." But by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. I'm sure this isn't painful for you as it is me. Then Satan took him up to the holy city and set him on the pinnacle of the temple. Again, conditionally, he throws out this challenge. If you are the Son of God, throw yourself down. For it is written, he shall give angels charge concerning you. And Jesus said to him, it is written, you shall not tempt the Lord your God. So Satan again throws out this conditional charge to him. If you're the Son of God, then do this. Prove it to me. Again, Christ answered him, that you're not to tempt the Lord your God. Verse 8, and the devil took him up to an exceedingly high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms and all their glory. And what did he offer him then? He said, all this can be yours. You can have this all if you will just fall down and worship me. Satan offered Christ the crown without the cross. He was feeding on his ego. You can have this now. You can be this king. You can have all creation. Jesus said to him, "Away with you, Satan, for it is written, 'You shall worship the Lord your God, and him only shall you serve.'" Christ's humility was tested during his trial and his crucifixion. Let's turn back to Mark 15. Mark chapter 15, verses 15 through 20. So Pilate, wanting to gratify the crowd, released Barabbas to them, and he delivered Jesus after he had scourged him to be crucified. Then the soldiers led him away into the hall called Praetorium, and they called together the whole garrison. And they clothed him with purple, and they twisted a crown of thorns put on his head, and began to salute him, "Hail, King of the Jews." Then they struck him on the head with a reed, they spat on him, and bowing the knee, they worshipped him. And when they had mocked him, they took the purple off and put his own clothes on him, and led him out to crucify him. What would your response be to that? If you had the power that Christ had available to him. Christ's humility was tested throughout his trial. And also in his crucifixion, if you turn to Matthew 27, verses 40 to 42. Matthew 27. Again, the crucifixion was meant as a humiliation. Matthew chapter 27, verse 40 and 42, and saying, "You who destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, save yourself. If you are the Son of God, come down from the cross." Likewise, the chief priest, also mocking with the scribes and elders, said, "He saved others, himself he cannot save. If he is the King of Israel, let him now come down from the cross, and we will believe him." There's that mocking again. If you're the King of God, the Son of God, if you're the King of Israel. Well, obviously we know who was behind this mocking that they were throwing at Christ. Why did Satan attack Christ's humble attitude so much? Have you ever thought about that? What was it about Christ's humility that Satan was always trying to attack? Why did he keep using this tool over and over again? Because that's what brought Satan down. It worked on him, and he figured he could make it work on against Christ as well. In Isaiah 14, verses 13 to 14, speaking to Lucifer, it says, "For you have said in your heart, 'I will ascend into heaven. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will also sit on the mountain of the congregation on the farthest sides of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High.'" Again, this is what Satan was trying to offer Christ in a way when he offered him all the kingdoms of the earth. If he would just fall down and worship him. He wanted him to lose that humble attitude. The next aspect of the foot washing attitude is that of service. Let's go back to John 13, verse 5. I guess I could have told you we're going to be going back there a few times, but it's not like it's hard to find. John 13. Verse 5. After that, he poured water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel with which he was girded. Foot washing was a service that was one that was provided, that one would provide for their guests. It was usually done by a servant, and usually the lowest of the low servants. Christ lived this service of this attitude of service for others. Let's turn back to Matthew chapter 20. Matthew 20, verses 25 to 28. Christ had to explain to the disciples what a servant even was, because they had a very distorted view of what a servant was to be. So Christ had to explain to them what a servant was. Matthew 20, verses 25 to 28. But Jesus called them to himself and said, "You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and those who are great exercise authority over them. Yet it shall not be so among you, but whoever desires to become great among you, let him be your servant. And whoever desires to be first among you, let him be your slave. Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many." Christ came as a servant. He healed the sick. He taught in the temple. He was always involved in some sort of service to those around him, even if it was just feeding them sometimes when they were all there and it was dinner time and they were hungry. He had to teach his disciples what a true leader was, because they had this perverted view because of the leaders around them. And we too can have this view of what a leader is by those that we see who are in authority and what they do. Turn with me, if you will, to Luke chapter 22. We're going to be reading verses 24 to 27. Luke chapter 22, verses 24 to 27. "Now there was a dispute among them as to which of them should be considered the greatest. And he said to them, 'The kings of the Gentiles exercise lordship over them, and those who exercise authority over them are called benefactors.'" Do you know what a benefactor is? A benefactor is someone who gives a great deal of money, usually, to an organization. A benefactor is someone who leaves large endowments to different schools or to a city or anything where they make a large contribution. They bestow great gifts on people or organization. This title suggests that the people should have been grateful for their generous leaders. Should we be grateful for our generous leaders? When I read this the other day, I began to think of the late Senator Bob Byrd. I don't know if you remember him or not. He's dead now. He was a senator from West Virginia. I used to live down there in that area, so his name was one that we heard a lot. I looked it up online last night. There's 40 or 50 things throughout the state named for Senator Byrd or his wife. One website jokingly said now they just can clear the way to change the name of the state. But the people down there loved Senator Byrd. Do you know why? They considered him a benefactor, because it seemed like he was always giving them great things and building things there and putting highways in. It wasn't his money. What a perverted view we have when we look at someone like that as a benefactor, when all they're doing is taking it from us and then giving it back and putting their name on it. So Christ was introducing to them a new form of a leader, how to be a leader. He says, "The kings of the Gentiles exercise lordship over them, and those who exercise authority over them are called benefactors, but not so among you. On the contrary, he who is greatest among you, let him be as the younger, and he who governs as he who serves. For who is greater, he who sits at the table or he who serves? Is it not he who sits at the table? Yet I am among you as the one who serves. but you are those who have continued with me in my trials. And I bestow upon you a kingdom, just as my Father bestowed it upon me, that you may eat and drink at my table in my kingdom, and sit on thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel. So Christ was explaining to them what a servant was. And that's what the attitude that Christ had as he was washing their feet. So how do we maintain this foot-washing attitude throughout the year? Well, we must become like Christ. We need to have love, to be humble, and to serve others. Again, these are just three aspects that I've picked out from these five verses of Christ washing the disciples' feet. There's many more aspects to the foot-washing attitude, but I'm just looking at these three this morning. So how do we become ones with these attitudes? John 13, verses 34 to 35. Jesus Christ said, "A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another as I have loved you, that you should also love one another. By this will all men know that you're my disciples, if you have love for one another." That is the sign of God's people, that we have this attitude of love. Do you feel like you have this attitude of love? Now remember, the commandment was that we love one another as Christ has loved us. That's a deep love. Certainly something we can all work on. It's to be the identifying sign of God's people. We're to have this love. Let's turn to John 15, verses 9 through 17. John 15, verses 9 through 17. In my Bible, this has the heading, "Love and Joy Perfected." "As the Father loved me, I also have loved you. Abide in my love." So the standard for Christ's love for us is the love that the Father had for him. "As the Father loved me, I also have loved you. If you keep my commandments, you will abide in my love, just as I have kept my Father's commandments and abide in his love. These things I have spoken to you, that my joy may remain in you, and that your joy may be full. This is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you." Again, Christ puts that out there as a commandment. We're to love one another as Christ loved us. "Greater love has no one than this, than to lay down one's life for his friends." And we know Christ ultimately did do that for all of us, laid down his life. But we also have the opportunity every day of our life to lay down our life for somebody else. Not physically give up your whole life, but to take a little bit of time out of your life for somebody. We have the opportunity to lay down our lives for others. "No longer do I call you servants, for a servant does not know what his master is doing, but I have called you friends, for all things that I heard from my Father I have made known to you. You did not choose me, but I chose you and appointed you that you should go and bear fruit, and that your fruit should remain, that whatever you ask the Father in my name, he may give you. These things I command you, that you love one another." Again, there's that commandment of love. The other thing we're to do is to become humble. You remember when the apostles started arguing among themselves who was the greatest? That was right after the Passover service. The argument arose as to who of them was the greatest. Not even who knows how long after Christ had just went around the room and washed their feet, they began to argue about who among them was the greatest. Romans 12 verse 3 tells us, "Do not think of yourself more highly than you ought to think." So that bears the question, how high ought we to think of ourselves? Well, Let's just put it this way. We know that we're all sinners. And we know that the punishment for sin is death. So how high should we think of ourselves? We don't even deserve to live. But Christ did not deserve to die. So we are to remain humble and not think highly of ourselves. And just as everything that Christ tells us, if Mr. McCready was here today, he'd be happy to hear this one. There's a reason that Christ wants us to become humble for our benefit. There's a blessing for being humble. 2 Chronicles 7 and verse 14. You don't have to turn there. I'll just read it to you. 2 Chronicles 7 verse 14 says, "If my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven and I will forgive their sin and heal their lands." God hears our prayers when we're humble. God's willing to heal us and our lands when we are humble and we turn to Him. The other thing we are to do is to take on an attitude of service. We're to serve one another. The opportunity is always there to serve. You know, you look around at this hall right now. It doesn't come like this. Somebody sets it up. The sound system's not up here. Somebody sets that up. If you go through the food line and you look on the other side of the glass there, or the serving area, there's people back there. There's always an opportunity to serve. And if that's not something that you can get into and can do, there's still the opportunity there to serve. This video that Mr. Hemsley showed today, I saw someone with a servant's heart. I don't know how I would react if I was born without arms and legs. I can't imagine myself going around giving encouragement to people in schools and prisons and churches and hospitals. I don't know, I can't say, but that person had a servant's heart. And obviously there was many things he couldn't do to serve others, but there was some things he could. So we all have the opportunity to serve. We can pray for one another. Many of you have come up to me and told me that you've been praying for my mother and everything, and I really appreciate that. That's a nice feeling to know that people are praying for you. And it's, I know that we pray for each other. You know, we can send cards to each other. There's people out there that getting a card or a letter means the world to them. And I have to say that's one area that I miserably fail in. I keep thinking I'm going to do that and I'm going to reach out to people who can't make it to services regularly. And it's amazing how busy our lives can get sometimes. But we need to take the moments that it takes to serve one another in ways like that. You see, the opportunity to serve is always there. Let's turn back again to John 13, verses 4 through 5. John 13, verse 4. Jesus rose from supper, laid aside his garments, took a towel, and girded himself. After that, he poured water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel with which he was girded. Peter and John made the room ready. The room was ready for the Passover meal. Apparently, there was even a foot washing station because it was the custom of the time. When someone would come into your house to visit, apparently you would wash their feet and made them feel welcome, made them feel refreshed. Christ didn't have to go to a well and draw out water. He didn't have to go next door and borrow a basin, go down to the corner market and buy a towel. Everything was right there in the room. The opportunity was there. The only thing missing was someone lowly enough to do the service. We're to be servants just as Christ was. There's a saying that charity is a coat that the world puts on at Christmas. That's why you see so many you know, the kettles at the stores when you're leaving, and someone playing a trombone or ringing a bell, or you get a lot of phone calls or a lot of mail that time of the year, people asking you to give. And I'm not putting down any charities. I think it's great the work that they do. I'm glad that there's some out there that are helping people. But it seems to be right around Christmas time, doesn't it? It's when the world's reflecting back on their year and maybe looking at the sometimes excessive amount of money that they're getting ready to spend on things. That's why these people hang out at the stores, and they maybe get a little bit of a guilt trip from these people as they're leaving to get an offering from them. We must be careful that the foot washing attitude is not a coat that we put on just around Passover time of the year, but it's to be a way of life, something that we keep with us once the Passover is over as we go throughout the year. We're to maintain that foot washing attitude all year. In conclusion, I would like to read John 13, verses 1 through 5 once again. And as we go through this, I want you to think of the attitude that Christ had and the example that he set and how we are to live our lives. Now before the feast of Passover, when Jesus knew that his hour had come and that he should depart from this world to the Father, having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. And supper being ended, the devil having already put it into the heart of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, to betray him, Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands, and that he had come from God, and that he was going to God, rose from supper, laid aside his garments, took a towel, and girded himself. After that, he poured water into a basin, and began to wash the disciples' feet, and to wipe them with the towel with which he was girded.